Overhead Door Company, the original garage door company, serving you for over 90 years. Call 843-767-0028 or overheaddoorco.com. Overhead Door Company of Charleston, proud to open hour two of the Morrow Midday Show.
This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? 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 Guess who's back?
Second hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, we'll talk some golf in just a few moments with Jeremy Schilling. Plus, is Dabo afraid of ever going to the SEC? We'll get to that later on. The Gamecocks have their new quarterback, the new boss, same as the old boss, Zeb Nolan, taking over for the rest of the way this year. What does the rest of this season look like for South Carolina? As they strive for a bowl game, how would you order the rest of their opponents in terms of win probability? Plus, I have some thoughts on the opening night of the NBA season last night. And we'll continue to get ready for a big night in the Major League Baseball postseason. An anxiety-filled Wednesday. Red Sox Astros tonight. Braves Dodgers, the late game. Got plenty to do throughout the afternoon. I was just reading, by the way, this interesting thread online about playoff games taking so long in baseball. They're up to now, on average, a little over 3.5 hours is the average playoff game, which is twice as long as the first playoffs in Major League Baseball, which was back in like 1908. Those games only were half as long as they currently are today. And a couple of factors, of course, you know, you have more commercials and TV time, more pitchers are being used. The amount of time spent in between pitches is much greater now than it's ever been, but also a lot more foul balls because either the pitching is better than it's been or even the hitting's not quite as good, and so guys foul off a lot more pitches than actually put them in play. You have some longer at-bats, a lot of swings and misses, extended counts, pitchers being a little careful, so a lot more pitches are thrown. We saw that last night. It took 2 hours to get through, or I should say it took over 1 hour to get through the first two innings in the ALCS, and the Astros needed 60 pitches to get through those first two innings, and yet it was still just a 2-1 game. But drawn out, we have added 40 minutes onto the average playoff game in the last 30 years. Now, that's a common complaint for most people when it comes to baseball. For me, it's as long as it's a good game, and playoff games always are, they're dramatic, right? I don't mind so much. Plus, with my schedule and my sleep schedule, I don't mind either. These games go till midnight. That's fine. I'm up that late anyways watching King of Queen reruns either way. So I'd rather watch some playoff baseball, especially if my team's in it. But these games are, in that Red Sox-Astros series, 3 out of 4 games have taken over 4 hours. It is a large investment. And like one of my brothers said last night in the group text with my family, right, you sit around, you spend 4 hours watching the game just to see your team blow it in the end. Happened for both the Braves and the Red Sox. You invested 4 hours last night in this game just for the wheels to come off. And you're like, well, that was a waste of 4 hours. Waited around to see that. Why couldn't they just do that in the second inning and put me out of my misery and I could go do something else tonight? We'll see how the games go today. 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock, big games in the AL and NLCS. We'll get back to that later on. But we talk golf at this time every Wednesday with our resident golf expert. You can find him on Twitter, at Jay Schill. He writes for PGA Magazine. He's Jeremy Schilling, and he joins us every week. He's with us now. Jeremy, good afternoon. How are you?
It is intolerable, the pace at which some of these games are played. And I think the other issue, and maybe this is just recency bias, is I feel like there's more timeouts granted by umpires to both hitters, catchers, and pitchers. And that's not helping anything whatsoever when you've got all this buildup and then, nah, I want some more time.
Yeah, and the biggest issue, I think, and when for me, you know, when my team's in it, it's okay. I don't mind. If I'm watching another game, I probably would like it to be moving at a quicker pace if I don't have that tied-in rooting interest. But the biggest problem, and it's been like this for a couple of years, is just the amount of time that guys spend in between pitches. The hitter gets out of the box on average, I think it's like 13 seconds between pitches. To me, you know, just get back in there and hit. Enough of this in between pitches. And in the playoffs, when you ramp up, every pitch is so important. The pitcher and the catcher wants to make sure they're on the same page. The hitter's got to make sure he has the signs and the third base coach. Everything slows down. That doesn't help either. But, you know, if it's a good dramatic game, it's okay. I don't mind it so much as most baseball fans do. It helps build some of the drama.
And here's the other thing, Luke. At 11:30 tonight, live on Golf Channel, you've got the Zozo Championship, which is being played in Japan. So because of the time difference, it'll be 12:30 p.m. over there, and you can enjoy some golf to fall asleep to in case the baseball is out of, you know, is so out of touch that you just decide to switch.
Perfect. Yeah, they'll be in about the fourth inning by then of the baseball game. So, you know, if it's
Joe
already a blowout.
And Buck will be at risk for missing Thursday night football because the game will still be going on.
That's right. He'll have to go right there after the baseball game to do his next assignment. Speaking of golf, let's talk some golf.
Yeah.
First, with what happened this past weekend, Rory gets the win at the CJ Cup at Summit, doing it in, as you described, an unusual or not usual Rory way. What stood out to you about his win and performance this past weekend?
I'm not Justin Ray, who's the best that there is when it comes to parlaying stats together, but I can't remember the last time that Rory McIlroy finished first in strokes gained putting. He gained 3 strokes in the greens in the first round, 2.5 in the second round when he shot 62, and when he really surged to the top of this event, eagling 18, and he only had 1 bogey over the whole weekend. And yes, the most important moment was the putt-in birdie on 14, but he also had some nice par saves. But most importantly, he kept driving it well. He was second in strokes gained off the tee. That even though his irons weren't super sharp, especially on let me just get the right date here, especially Thursday, Friday, when he wound up finishing negative in strokes gained for the week, 67 of 71 guys, I believe, 77 guys, who wound up competing in this event, he was still able to get the title. And that just speaks to how good the putter was and how good the driver was. But what was really interesting, Luke, is you've heard me say this before. Rory is the sexiest driver swinging golf. And people laugh at me, but it's just a thing of beauty to watch. He put that thing in the bag for the majority of the back nine, hitting 3 woods and a hybrid, playing a very conservative style of golf that's very un-Rory McIlroy-like. Yes, he drove the green in number 12 and had a birdie that way, a two-putt birdie that way, but very unlike Rory McIlroy in how he wins it. And then he really revealed himself afterwards, which I know you're about to get to.
Yeah, let's get to that as we talk golf with Jeremy Schilling on Twitter at Jay Schill. This mental breakthrough for Rory that, you know, as you had told me off air, we can all learn something from. Explain that.
Have you ever, when you were growing up, Luke, did you try to be somebody? Were you trying to, as you announce things in the shower, were you trying to be your favorite announcer of all time?
I think everyone was growing up trying to be like me, but yes, I get what you're saying. Yeah, of course, I tried to. You would always try to be like those broadcasters you grew up listening to.
And it's cliche, but in the end, you found your own voice, mm-hmm. and I don't think you make one call, either in your radio style or in your play-by-play style, that is similar to somebody else. You're not coming on the air saying, hello, friends.
I'm not doing that, no.
And what Rory realized is that he spent most of 2021 trying to be somebody else. We've talked before about him chasing distance. We talked before about him seeing Pete Cowan for some coaching advice because Michael Bannon, who's based over in Ireland, was having trouble getting to the U.S. because of all the COVID travel restrictions. And in the end, Rory found that being himself is good enough. And that's where that emotion from the Ryder Cup came from. Because he realized that on that Ryder Cup Saturday night, after he let his team down and failed to earn a point in the first, 2 days of the Ryder Cup, he was going to put the clubs away and not tee it up once more in 2021. And he decided on Sunday, all I can do is win my match. And he forgot about swing thought. and he just played golf. And that's when the switch turns for a lot of people. He played great and won his match on Sunday. You saw all that emotion pour out. He joked this week that he doesn't know where it comes from because he rarely cries on the golf course, so he's not quite sure what happened to his body. But that's just the Ryder Cup. And he got choked up talking about it on the 72nd green on Sunday. And just being him and playing Rory golf ultimately does it. And he gets the title and his 20th PGA Tour win. That is a hugely significant number. He's the 39th person to cross that threshold. In 2 years, when he gets 15 years of service, he will have lifetime membership on the PGA Tour. That means he can play as much or as little as he wants, and he can never lose his card, which is very significant. Davis Love, Phil, Dustin Johnson, Tiger, Vijay are the most notable active guys in that category. Rory will join them after the 2023 season.
Yeah, interesting. You know, when you were on with us last week, as we were getting ready for this event this past weekend and talking about some guys with their home course and everything, Colin Morikawa, one of those guys playing on his home course, and we saw him, you know, start to climb that leaderboard and really surge on Sunday, getting within a stroke of Rory. So what were your takeaways from Morikawa playing on his home course this past weekend and being the runner-up?
Yeah, it's really awkward being at home.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you've ever felt like your parents are in town and now you have to change the way you're broadcasting to, like, make sure you have a good game and maybe you, like, over-prepare in a sense, or you spend a lot of time just because you're trying to impress somebody. And I think for anybody in their job, right, you're home, you're trying to show off your house, you clean it to the nth degree. And I think Colin tried to do too much, and he went 65-62 on the weekend. He put a scare in the Rory. He eagled 18 by hitting a 4-iron from 249 playing uphill, which is just absurd, and landed it as soft as a pitching wedge, and ultimately made eagle and forced Rory to play well down the stretch to win by one. So really good stuff from Colin Morikawa, and I know we're going to talk about Ricky in a second, but as you look towards the guys who made the charter flight from Vegas to Japan for this week, headlined by Xander Schauffele trying to go for the Japan double, but right behind him is Colin Morikawa and Hideki Matsuyama. We will preview that momentarily, but it's an interesting thought as to if that can carry over into this week where he's suddenly freed up, not at home.
Yeah, you mentioned Ricky Fowler. You know, sometimes you can feel good even about a loss. And for Fowler, he finished in third in this case, but you came away seeing some progress from him this past weekend?
Totally. Luke, I can't remember. By the way, Rory was second in stroke gained off the tee. Ricky was first. Cannot remember the last time Ricky was first in that category. 10th in his short game. He was the fifth longest driver for the week. But most impressively, when you start out 66-63, you come into Sunday, your first time in this spot in a while, and how do you handle adversity? And unfortunately for Ricky, he made a double bogey on the par 5-6 after he needed to take an unplayable. He failed the birdie, the par 5-12. And drivable par 4-12 and failed to really make anything around the turn for birdie. And it just didn't fall. But the signs in his game, whether it's the bogey 363 from Saturday or just the way he struck it, the way he looked fitter, he looked happier. I really like the signs for Ricky. I don't know how much we're going to see him the rest of the year because he's got a baby on the way, him and his wife Allison. But this is a big week. I would not be surprised if Ricky ends up in the winner's circle.
Talking golf with Jeremy Schilling, who's on Twitter at Jay Schill, our resident golf expert. Before we get to what's going on this weekend with that Zozo Championship, tell me about this Rose Zhang, 18 years old. Why should we know that name with what she's been doing?
She's a high school freshman, college freshman, at Stanford, who just won her first three events. That's something Tiger didn't do. It's not something Patrick Rogers did. It's not something any of these famous Stanford guys that have come out have done, what Rose Zhang has done. Everybody knew to watch out for her. U.S. women's, oh God, I should know this offhand. Yeah, U.S. women's amateur champion, if I'm not mistaken. And just what she has done in her career. Yeah, U.S. women's amateur 2020, and then wins the U.S. Girls Junior this year, becoming the first person to win the women's AM, followed by the Girls Junior in modern times, kind of going in reverse order versus what most people do. And she won the McCormick medal as top-ranked amateur to finish out 2020. This play from her is just utterly absurd, and it's wild, and this is going to continue, and you're going to hear this name, Rose Zhang, for a long, long time. And the way she's been playing, too, is just insanely impressive. Really hard to come out with all these expectations and freewheel it like she's been doing. Really impressive stuff.
So now we have the Zozo Championship this weekend. As you mentioned, you can unwind. Braves fans can after the playoff baseball tonight with some golf. What do you expect for this tournament this weekend?
It teased last week that this is an anomaly, and the reason why is it's the only one of the Asian swing events that's taking place in Asia. So you've got a weird field with some guys who hop planes and then some people who did not hop planes. It is headlined, as I said, by Dan Durs trying to back up his gold medal at the Olympics with a victory. Morikawa, Hideki Matsuyama trying to win at home. Will Zalatoris, those are kind of your headliners. The bunch of really solid golfers who hopped this charter from Vegas and made the trip. But I really think we're primed for somebody to break through for the first time. If people remember back to the Tiger victory of 2019, the only time this event was played at this golf course, it rained a lot. There was a tsunami, but it's one of those hot, humid climates where you tend to have afternoon thunderstorms. Distance becomes a must, and that fits Luke List, one of the longest players in the game, pound for pound, who has still not broken through for his first PGA Tour win. I think it happens, and it happens on foreign soil this week in Japan.
I like it. Luke List, that's the pick. Good name. I like him. I think he's going to do well this weekend. Are you going to stay? What's the plan? Are you staying up? You're going to watch some late-night golf this
no
weekend?
No way. No way. The only way I would stay up is if I happen to be out, like socially. But, like, tonight, there's no way I'm staying up till 2:30, which is when the coverage window ends.
So then do you watch it on, the DVR the next – come the final round. What's the plan for that? You going to watch it, on the DVR the next day?
I absolutely will. I will try to stay spoiler-free. We'll see how well I do with that. It also depends where I am, if I'm home or not. But if I'm home and if I'm sitting here, the general way I've done the Asian swing is – DVR the final round, give bonus time for any playoffs, and then tune in halfway through and see what you get.
Yeah. Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up about avoiding the spoilers. I'm with you. I always, if I know the score, I don't even bother going back and watching whatever game I was trying to catch up on. So you have to avoid all spoilers.
Yeah, I'm okay doing that because the way I have my notifications is I only get who the winner is.
Ah.
So there's also the how. How did it happen?
Yeah, but that's the winner. That's 75% of the whole thing. I want to go in fresh. I want to go in with no idea of anything that happened and just I'm seeing it like it's live that moment. That's what I try to do.
Well, you would have laughed then during the Olympics because when I took down those two pages of notes for you guys, I was literally flipping. I literally was tilting my phone slightly just to make sure I wasn't missing anybody's calls. Mm-hmm. Or text, anything important, and then I would, put it down and keep it on the charger. Simplest way, folks, to get your phone back to 100%.
Yeah.
Just have to ignore it.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's the one reason why you would ignore ignore your smartphone for so long, because you're trying to avoid any of the scores. He's Jeremy Schilling on Twitter at Jay Schill, our resident golf expert, joins us every Wednesday. Jeremy, appreciate the time as always, and we'll talk with you next week.
You got it, and go Knicks. They're the last hope for New York.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes with the NBA season getting underway last night. That's, you know, we already talked about Seinfeld earlier. That was the other classic thing. Jerry was trying to watch the Mets game on VHS tape late one night, and when he would pick up the phone, that would be the first thing he'd say. Right? If you know the score of the Mets game, don't tell me I'm watching it on tape, something along those lines. And then, of course, Kramer comes in and says, oh, the Mets really blew it tonight, right? And he's all upset. It is an effort. It's a little bit, I don't know if it's easier or harder now with the technology. You have to avoid more things. And then it's weird. We're so, at least if you're of a certain age, you're so stuck to your phone that if I'm trying to avoid the score of a game, right, you have to try to avoid your phone, but you use your phone for everything. And I, like, a lot of times, for example, I'll give you an example. I have a terrible sense of direction. I use my phone, the GPS, for everything. If I go to the grocery store, I have to use my GPS more often than not. And I've lived here. I've lived in the same place since moving here over 3 years ago. Still, just to get around town, I have a terrible sense of direction. So, you know, I use my phone for everything. I use it for the GPS. I'll use it for music when I'm driving. But, you know, I may be coming back from a game or something. I'm going to go home and watch the rest of the game. And then, you know, a text message pops up or something. You see something online when you're looking up something. And, it's difficult. You got to try to avoid that score so you can go watch the game afterwards. I actually thought about that with the Red Sox. I don't think I could pull that off today. Game's at 5 o'clock. I got the coach's show at 7. And I did think, like, what if I just ignore it and then come home, watch it fresh? But I don't think I could pull that off. I think that would be too hard. Too many people in my life, and I'll be at a bar with TV. I don't think I could do it. We're just going to have to find a way to navigate tonight through the coach's show with a stressful Red Sox game going on. We'll see what happens. When we come back, would Dabo Swinney ever change his stripes? Would he ever go to LSU? We'll get to that next. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, would Dabo ever swap one Tiger for the other? Would he ever be interested in LSU? It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time last segment from Jeremy Schilling, our resident golf expert. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. So, of course, the LSU job is open. Or will be. I guess it's not. I don't know. Can we say it's technically open yet, or do you have to wait till Ed O is gone? It's an awkward situation. It's like when you get divorced or separated from your spouse, but you know, you're still working through something. Like, they're still living at the house with you. They haven't moved out just yet. You're still going through that whole process. They're looking for another place. It wasn't such a bad ending that they have to go live in a hotel, right? But it was, the relationship came apart, and until they find something in a couple of weeks, till they move in somewhere, right? They're still living in the same house, a different bedroom. That's like what's going on here. We know it's coming to an end. It's been announced. They're going to find a replacement. But in the meantime, Ed O is going to continue to coach the rest of this season. We'll see how that goes for LSU. I mean, they did just beat Florida. But once they do get to the point where they have to hire that coach, and they're going to start already, they're starting the process, even if Ed Orgeron is there, would Dabo ever entertain that job? According to reports, the AD of LSU said he is going to make Dabo say no to him. And maybe that doesn't take much. One call to the agent. The agent says, nope, not interested. Okay, Dabo said no. Now, any business or any salesman will tell you have to hear no three times before you move on. Maybe not in a row. Right? Maybe not in the same conversation. This isn't Will Ferrell and Austin Powers. But, you know, they say no, come back. Maybe they change their minds. Come back maybe a year later. In this case, with a coaching search, you can't wait a year, but you get the idea. One no isn't just shutting the door. You have to hear it from them multiple times to make sure, okay, yep, he's really not interested in this vacuum I'm trying to sell him, or whatever it is. Don't just settle for the first no. But the idea is LSU, they want Dabo to tell them no. They want to make sure he isn't interested. And AD Scott Woodward he's expected to go big game fishing. I mean, they have the money to do so, and he's always kind of done so. Big game hunting, I should say. Or fishing. But he's always tried to. I mean, he hired Jimbo Fisher and gave him that big deal at Texas A&M. They hired Buzz Williams, gave him a big contract for basketball. He went after Kim Mulkey for women's basketball. He hired Chris Peterson before at Washington. That was a good get. I think if you go back far enough, I think he hired Brian Kelly before. You know, that was a good get. He's hired big-time coaches, and this is LSU we're talking about, so I think he's going to go for a big-time coach. I don't think you're going to bring in somebody that is seen as a little bit more of a risk or a gamble. I think you want some sort of big-time name that the fan base could really get excited about. And LSU, they have the money to throw around to do it. Right? Ed Orgeron, remember when he was hired, that wasn't a very exciting name. People did not like that hire around there. I think you go for a home run swing after what has happened these last 2 years with Ed O and the way, right? Because you always hired the opposite. So you brought in Ed Orgeron, or you promoted him, really, and he was a guy that didn't have much of a resume and, you know, wasn't some sort of great coach, but players liked him, and he had the great voice, and he was perfect for the area. Didn't work out. Got a little too comfortable. Maybe got a little too big of a head around the women of the area, whatever it was. Right? Didn't have good coordinators after that national title game. So you go out and you say, okay, enough of that. We have to get a big name, somebody who's done it before, who's won, who's going to come in here. They have a plan. They know what they're doing. They're more of an X's and O's guy than maybe a CEO, which doesn't exactly fit Dabo. He's more like an Ed Orgeron in the sense that they are more of a CEO, a program developer. You know, players like him. They're like a players type of guy. They can recruit. And then they have good coordinators to coach up the players on Saturday. But when it comes to LSU versus Clemson, and let me say this right off the top. No, I don't think Dabo would entertain this job. I don't think he's going to leave Clemson for LSU. Get that out of the way. But if you wanted to compare the two, if LSU wanted to call up Dabo's agent and try to make their case, what could LSU sell really any coach on, but in this case, Dabo specifically? Well, they do have the money, so they can pay a coach probably whatever they want. Whatever the coach wants. They have the resources. They are in the SEC. It is LSU. It's a big-time brand. People care, of course, about the program around there. Boosters. I mean, they're paying Ed Orgeron $17 million to go away after winning a national title 2 years ago. They have the money. They have the resources. No problem there. They have the conference. They're in the SEC. That's important. They get $45 million a year just for being in the SEC. It is the number one conference. And not only that, but what's unique about LSU is that they have no other competition around them from a Power 5 perspective, right? Like Clemson is obviously not in the SEC, but they have South Carolina to deal with. Texas A&M and Texas have one another to deal with. That's why Texas A&M originally went to the SEC to get away from Texas. Florida has a lot of competition. Florida State, Miami, even if you want to say UCF, a lot of schools in the area, and UCF's not a Power 5, but they're the next closest thing. Right? Most schools, Alabama and Auburn, most schools you have somebody down the road that you're competing with. Even Georgia, Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech may not be much competition, but they're there. LSU, who do you have around you from a Power 5 perspective that you're competing with in a state that has tons of talent? That's another great appeal for LSU. It's why they always have great recruiting classes, even when they're 500. Right? They still pull in a top 5 recruiting class because there's so much talent around there, and you want to go play for that school if you're from that area. And then, additionally, as just mentioned, there is the talent. That's another box you check. And LSU is just kind of built to win. The last three coaches there have all won a national championship. And the last two, I don't know how good of coaches they really are. You know, like Nick Saban was the first one. Great coach. Nick Saban could win a national championship at any of these big-time programs. I really believe that. But the next two coaches, like Les Miles, if you put Les Miles at most other jobs, is he having the same success? Ed Orgeron? Ed Orgeron bottomed out in the SEC a decade earlier. Big-time failure. Was never seen as a head coach. Takes over, he wins a national championship at LSU. If you put Ed O somewhere else in the SEC, do we think they're winning a national championship? Do you think he builds them back up to win a national championship at a Florida today or a Georgia? Or, I don't know, put them in the Big Ten at one of those schools that they're trying to make that last push. Send them to Michigan right now or Penn State. Do you think he's doing the same thing that they're currently achieving? I don't think so. But he won a national championship at LSU, and that's not to take anything away, but it's just a program that's built to win. Between the money, the resources, the lack of competition in the area, the amount of talent around there, the fact that they are in the SEC, yes, it makes things more difficult on a week-to-week basis to perform, but it also helps you in recruiting and exposure and the money that you make and to sell your product. But when you want to talk about Dabo specifically, well, look at Clemson. They kind of offer a lot of the same things. I mean, number one, plenty of money. Dabo's getting paid so much, it's hard for another school to swipe in and say, right, we're going to give you all the money you could dream of. It's hard to pay more than what Dabo is already getting. And if push comes to shove, I'm sure Clemson could up that offer to keep him around as well. He could use LSU, if he really wanted to, he could probably use LSU as some sort of leverage play to get even more money out of his current deal. I don't think money is the issue. Job security, much greater at Clemson. You go to LSU, I mean, Ed Orgeron was just fired 2 years, less than 2 years after winning a national championship. Dabo, meanwhile, at Clemson, he's a god. He's not going anywhere unless he chooses anytime soon. The money is already there, like I said. And then on top of it all, you have the ACC versus the SEC. And Clemson fans or ACC fans can get real defensive about this, but as we say here on the show, right, it should be looked at as a good thing. What do we always say? Work smarter, not harder. And for Clemson, you have the much easier path in the ACC than if you have to go to the SEC. And people always think that's like a dig, right? Clemson fans get real defensive. You start making excuses, try to compare resumes. Oh, the SEC is not as good. Oh, Clemson does this against SEC teams. Look, just accept the fact the SEC is the best conference in football. That's not a bad, that's okay. Stay in the ACC. You got an easier path. Let them battle each other out every year. Let Ed Orgeron lose his job 2 years after winning a national championship. That's fine. Let people call for Dan Mullen's job. Let Kirby Smart be seen as, you know, an underachiever every year with a lot of pressure on him. That's okay. They can deal with that in the SEC. I'll stay over here in the ACC and just dominate and go to the playoff every year and win a couple of national championships. I don't know why this is seen as a bad thing. To me, it's a good thing. That's fine. Stay here. And you want to say, you know, it's not as big of a challenge as the SEC? That's okay. That's fine. I'll take the easier path. Call me lazy. I'll take the easier path to the playoff, and then we'll go head-to-head in the playoff and see if we could beat you then. Fine with me. I'll do that. But that's a big advantage in Dabo's case with Clemson. Is LSU like a bigger brand, bigger-time job? Yeah, sure, but it's also a lot more difficult. There's certainly a lot less job security. There'll be a lot more pressure on you. You have to kind of start new there, whereas at Clemson, I mean, you're the guy in town and on campus. I don't think he would entertain it, ever entertain leaving. I think if he does go to the SEC ever, in fact, if Dabo ever leaves Clemson for another college football job, I would say the only one is Alabama. I don't know why you'd go anywhere else other than the NFL, right? Like an Urban Meyer, who, of course, retired first for another time. But if Dabo leaves Clemson, to me, it would either be for Alabama because, of course, played there, coached there, from there, that whole connection, or just to go to the NFL because that's a step up. But why go to LSU? I mean, LSU on paper is a bigger job than Clemson. You know, it's a better brand, better job, bigger time program historically in college football. It is the SEC, but, I mean, with what you already built, unless Clemson really starts to slide and you realize, like, oh, yeah, it's going to be a lot of hard work to get us back to where we were the last couple of years, and you want to jump ship before it sinks, I would get that and go take a crack somewhere else where it could be a little bit easier, already a little ready-made, sure. I don't think that's the case right now, but otherwise, right, it's kind of a lateral, if not like a, you know, like I guess best case, it'd be kind of be a lateral move. Going from Clemson to LSU, historically LSU is a better job, but for someone like Dabo, just stay at Clemson. Right, like USC is open right now. I don't think Dabo would work on the West Coast, but USC is a big brand. You know, would that be worth it? Would that be a smart career move to go out there to coach USC just because they're the Trojans? I don't think so. Just stay at Clemson. But they were talking about this on the J-Boy Show, which is a podcast with the Volume Sports Network about college football, specifically the SEC. And J-Boy, the host of the show, was talking about if Dabo would ever go to the SEC or is he too scared to ever give a try in the SEC?
I think deep down, Dabo doesn't want any part of the SEC.
Wow.
Honestly.
Now, that's a hot take.
Where he played and won a national title.
I don't think he wants any. So he's going to be the one that goes to Bama after Saban?
I thought he said Cristobal.
He wants to wear the crown. No, I'm talking. Man, let me answer the question that you're saying real quick. What I'm saying is, I don't think Dabo wants to be the one that follows Nick Saban because you can do nothing but do worse.
Okay.
And I don't think he wants to jump in the SEC while Saban's at Bama, while Kirby's at Georgia and all these other. He's sitting pretty over there in Clemson, man. The ACC, Clemson's had one bad year. You know what? In this recruiting class they're going to bring I guarantee you they run through the SEC like well water next year. I bet. I don't think Dabo wants the smoke in the SEC. I don't think he wants it. You want to know why? Because in my opinion, if he did, he'd be over here already.
That was the J-Boy Show. I mean, not necessarily he'd be in the SEC already. I don't know about opportunities in the past, but again, it has to be really something special to leave Clemson and what he's built there. I don't know if he would be afraid to go to the SEC. If I'm him, and it always comes down to ego with these coaches. Maybe you have the ego that you want to go test yourself in the premier conference, the SEC, but otherwise, you're winning national championships in the ACC with an easier path. Why change that? Right? Why have to work harder when you can just work smarter, as we say around here? if he were to go for any job in the SEC, I would only see it as being Alabama. But I do agree, you don't want to be the guy that replaces the legend. You want to be the guy to replace the guy who replaced the legend. You don't want to follow up right after Saban. Let them go hire somebody else. He can bottom out. He can bomb for 4 years. And then you replace that guy when expectations are at their lowest, and you come in to be the guy that saves the day. I agree with that. I think he would be just fine recruiting with LSU going up against those other coaches. If he brings his coordinators with him, I mean, they've beaten SEC teams before. They've gone head-to-head with SEC coaches. I think they'd be okay there at LSU if he brought his staff there. So much talent in that state, and it is still the South, you know, the Southeast he could recruit. I just don't think it's worthwhile. Why leave Clemson for LSU or for any other job that may not be Alabama? Woodward may want Dabo at LSU. I don't think we'd ever get to a serious point where you have to consider that. Coming up, now that Luke Doty's out for the year, Gamecocks go back to Zeb. What's the outlook this year? What are the most winnable games left on the schedule? Can they get to a bowl game? We'll get to that next. It's the Mara Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Mara Midday Show.
It's much too groovy a summer's day.
What's the outlook for the Gamecocks here the rest of the season? Get to that on the Mara Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. I was talking during one of the commercial breaks. I was getting a little refill of my water. And our program director, Terry, around here, big-time Gamecock fan, optimistic Gamecock fan, we made a lunch bet at the start of the season, which we were just debating over. I still believe he said over 6 wins. He claims he said 6 or more wins. But still, as we spoke a few moments ago, earlier this hour during a commercial break, he said he still feels confident they get to 7 wins for South Carolina. The focus for me would be on the 6. Try to get to a bowl game with 5 games remaining, trying to win 2 out of those 5. Where could those 2 wins come from? Well, if you look at ESPN's FPI, Missouri is still the most winnable game. I think we could all agree on that. ESPN's FPI gives South Carolina a 43% chance of beating Missouri. Missouri is not nearly as good as I thought they would be this year. Their defense has been a train wreck. Even though it's on the road for South Carolina, that is very much a winnable game. I would put it closer to 50%. I think that's a little bit more of a coin flip game for South Carolina against Missouri. And that may be the only winnable game left on the schedule. A couple other games could be won, just like anytime you take the field. I mean, you could win. It's just far less likely. It'd be quite the upset. And South Carolina has been known to pull off one upset along the way here or there. Maybe they can accomplish that. But for their other games this season, ESPN's FPI gives them an 18% chance to beat Auburn, which looks like a tougher game now than maybe a few weeks ago. Bo Nix has been playing better lately, and it is year one of Brian Harsin. They've been getting better as the year goes on. So by the time South Carolina sees them, still in about a month, they'll probably be even better than they are now. They just beat Arkansas on the road. A ranked Arkansas team beat them by over 2 touchdowns. That looks like a tougher game now than maybe at the start of the year. Florida, South Carolina has just a 15% chance of beating Florida. Florida looks like a team that's more vulnerable now than they were just a couple of weeks ago. But it is still Florida. I mean, maybe they get to a point where the season's kind of lost. They've lost 6 of their last 8 against Power 5 teams. They have this whole quarterback issue. You get to play them next week in your building. The Gamecocks have always played Florida tough, but there is more talent on Florida's roster, and I do like their head coach more. A 15% chance, I would put that higher. In fact, I'd put the 18% against Auburn a little higher as well. I'm not telling you the Gamecocks would win either one. They now have a 14% chance of beating Clemson at the end of the year. 14% chance there. And for their game Saturday, in which the Gamecocks are a 3-touchdown underdog on the road against Texas A&M, they have only an 11% chance of winning that game. So according to ESPN's FPI, the toughest games left on the schedule in order for the Gamecocks, Texas A&M, then Clemson's the next toughest, then Florida, Auburn, Missouri. And there's a big gap between Missouri and everybody else. If they were to get 2 wins the rest of the season to go to that bowl game, number one, of course, would have to be at Missouri on the road. That's the easiest game remaining. And then you'd have to pull one of those upsets. I don't think it'll happen Saturday at Texas A&M. It could happen against Florida at home. It could happen against Auburn at home. And I know Clemson looks like a lot more of a winnable game now, but I don't know if that will happen at the end of the year. You win one of those games, you do get to a bowl. Now, for Terry and myself and our bet, I still think the number was 7. That's a little more difficult. You have to pull off 2 of those games, which would still be seen as upsets. In fact, the Gamecocks will be underdogs in all of these remaining games. So you'd have to win 3 out of 5 games in which you're not expected to. That's a little more difficult for a team that doesn't have a convincing win yet all year, that needed a last-minute drive just to sneak past Vanderbilt at home. Hard to count on that against a better, bigger, more talented program like those that are still left on the schedule. Missouri is that number one game you circle. You got to have it. Get to that 5th win. Get another win in the conference. Winnable game on the road. You have to at least play well and compete in that one. And then when you look at the rest of that schedule, maybe you can sneak up on Florida. Dan Mullen has been known to cough up a couple of games that Florida really shouldn't lose. Maybe you can surprise Clemson at the end of the year with an offense that hasn't scored more than 20 points against a Power 5 school all season. They're very similar to South Carolina. 2 teams where their defense is better than their offense and their offense is struggling to score. Maybe South Carolina's boosted by this quarterback change. You never root for somebody to get injured. You always hope everyone's okay. But in terms of this season, trying to win games by the end of the year, Zeb coming in could be a good thing for South Carolina here down the stretch. Now, I was thinking about this yesterday with the Luke Doty news that, and you know what, we'll get to this when we come back because we have to take another break. We'll wrap up the second hour when we come back. But with the Luke Doty injury and these quarterback concerns with the Gamecocks, I thought back to the time Super Dave, before the start of the season, going back about 2 months, Super Dave had the solution, which could still be a solution for the Gamecocks quarterback situation here the rest of the year. And we'll get to that when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
It's our midday show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, we will solve the Gamecocks quarterback issues. Going back to something that was mentioned a couple of months ago here in the Morrow Midday Show. But let me get to this while we have just a few moments left in the second hour. We'll get back to the Gamecocks coming up, plus the Braves next hour. And a few thoughts on the NBA opening night last night as well. But, you know, I was hearing about the Heisman conversation. People are saying that Caleb Williams at Oklahoma is working his way into the Heisman conversation. And I remember talking to a former college coach a couple years ago when Larry Fedora was on the hot seat at UNC. He was the head coach before Mack Brown. And you may recall that UNC, they only started Mitch Trubisky his final year. Now, you're probably jaded by what you've seen from Trubisky in the NFL, but if you think back, without revisionist history to that 1 year, I mean, there was a reason why he went so high in the draft. That 1 year at UNC, he did play really well. And I remember the conversation I had with a former coach was saying in regards to Fedora, you know, if he was such a good coach or if he knew the quarterback position so well, how come he waited that long to start the better quarterback, Mitch Trubisky? And the same could be said for Dan Mullen, who I'm a big Dan Mullen guy around here. I think he's one of the best offensive minds in the country. But why go so long with Felipe Franks when you have Kyle Trask available? We saw the difference last year. And now this year, you could say the same thing. You know, why go so long with Emory Jones when the backup seems to be even better? And for Oklahoma, similar with Spencer Rattler compared to Caleb Williams, who's come in. All he has done is Oklahoma has scored on 17 of 24 possessions. That's essentially 70%, scoring on 70% of possessions with him. The offense, it's been a, you know, like a B12 shot. What a boost he has brought to them. And we're not in practice every day. The coaches are. We're not around these kids. They know what they're like, when they're ready, how they are as leaders, what they do in practice. Maybe some of these guys are bad practice players. One of my brothers played college basketball. He would tell you himself, great player in the games, wasn't a great practice player. His style, his style of game didn't translate as well into practice as it did games. And I remember his coach used to use against him when he would say, you know, Coach Jones called me, trying to recruit my brother. I told him, you're not a good enough practice player for him. You know, that was how he would motivate him. Some guys maybe just aren't as good in practice as they are in games. But a couple of coaches, especially more recently, Lincoln Riley, Dan Mullen, two of the best offensive coaches we have, who are leaving better talent on the bench. I think part of it, just like in the NFL, certain guys get more opportunities because of bigger contracts. I think certain players in college get more opportunities because of the star ratings and how they were recruited instead of how they actually look in practice. Larry Fedora made the mistake. Kind of cost him his job at UNC. Dan Mullen's made the mistake twice, and looks like Lincoln Riley made the same mistake with his quarterbacks. Hour 3 coming up next.